Ladies and gentlemen around the Delaware Valley, welcome to the Salts Mongoluzzi Bendeski Hour here on WWDB Talk 860. Fantastic show. Our guest from Salts Mongoluzzi is Michael Zettelmoyer, who is an associate here at the firm. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Joe.
It's great to have you on the broadcast, Mike. And if you will, a little bit about yourself, what you do here at the firm, type of cases that you represent.
Sure. Thanks, Joe, and thanks for having me on. I appreciate the time and being here. I handle catastrophic personal injury cases, just like many of the attorneys here at the firm. That involves the construction industry or highway fatalities, wrongful death, survival actions, and industrial machine incidents.
So having said that, let's talk about your career path. It's not like you know anything about engineering or anything like that. Am I right? I do my research too, Mike. Little bit about your career path and what brought you, you know, in this direction.
Yeah. So as a young man and growing up, I never really had a path towards or a drive to become an attorney. So it was a little bit winding road to get here. I grew up with a father who was a physics teacher, very interested in the sciences, went to school for engineering, stayed for my master's degree in engineering, civil engineering, and then worked for a structural engineering firm up in the Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania in the Allentown, Bethlehem area. And then I, during that process, we got involved in a lot of forensic engineering work, and we worked with attorneys. And the thought occurred to me in working with the attorneys we were that there would be some power to having my background and experience as an engineer and carrying that forward into actually practicing law. Because what I had experienced with the attorneys I was working with is that they were unable to ask the next question or the next question. I pursued law and I went to Drexel and got my law degree. And I guess path of least resistance, I immediately found myself representing design professionals, engineers, architects, geotechnical engineers, that sort of thing.
So you saw a need in the market. You went to law school, and was it as you expected when, you know, in other words, when you came out, I can only imagine walking in going, here's what I do, here's where my degrees are, and you were already in the industry. Did you was it as you suspected?
The law school itself?
No, when you came out and you saw the need somewhat in the market.
Yeah, my real value coming out of law school to the firm I worked with at that time was not necessarily what I could bring in terms of the law, but I had the engineering and I was representing the same folks that I had just worked with as colleagues within the industry. So I could read a set of plans. I knew where the specs were for a particular project or knew what areas to press on or needed to mitigate the risk. So that was that experience and did well at it and did that for 11 years on the defense side. And things really came full circle because by the end of my time on the defense side representing design professionals, I was hiring my boss that I worked with when I was a structural engineer as an expert on my cases.
Well, and that's I was going to say, were you an expert before you?
I never served as a formal expert.
You worked at the engineering firm.
Yeah, and we did some back house forensic engineering work for attorneys, but I would have been sort of the one, you know, boots on the ground back at the lab with the paper and the, sure, you know, the pencil and the calculator.
Yeah. What brought you to take us to when you came to SMB and what brought you here?
Yeah, so I in 2018 we had left our firm and started our own firm, and that was me and three guys, and it was a really rewarding experience. So I was an equity owner, founder of this firm.
Was it a defense firm?
Defense firm, continuing to represent the same clientele.
Okay.
And, you know, I found that very rewarding, but I always felt the pull or the interest to represent those that are catastrophically injured. And I've I flirted with the idea over a matter of time, and I tried to deny and push aside those feelings. But at some point, at 11 years out, the opportunity presented itself, and I couldn't ignore, you know, those feelings anymore. And it turns out it was one of the best decisions I've ever made, doing what I'm doing now, representing, you know, people that need someone in their corner like this firm is able to provide.
Having said that, the experience that you bring to the table from the defense side, which, as you well know, is kind of a common pathway to plaintiff's law.
Yeah.
Okay, having that experience and being able to bring that to the table. Talk about what that allows you to offer your clients since you understand the other side.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, aside from having the opportunity to work with some of the best trial attorneys in the country here at this firm, one of the compelling reasons to join was the opportunity to work day in and day out with Dave Quas. And Dave had a similar start as well. He had 9 years working on the defense side doing mal work.
Sure.
So the experiences are similar in the sense that you can really appreciate the process and the interplay between the insurance carriers, the clients, managing risk, understanding what are the things that get insurance carriers concerned, where to press on those issues. I mean, I went through the entire process where by the time I left, I had a book of business, and, you know, I was having those roundtable discussions with the powers that be at the insurance company. So you go through the whole CYA, you know, process with them, you really begin to understand what they're interested in and what they're concerned about. And, you know, now I leverage that on behalf of our clients here.
Couple things. Number one, shout out to Dave Quas. Of course, you're pinch hitting for him today, which is awesome. You know, when you think of, have you gone up, you know, against your previous firm yet? Have they, you know, has that happened?
Yeah, those.
You're kidding me! Oh my God!
Those guys are in a few cases with me, and I get a ton of respect for them, and still friends and colleagues with them, and enjoy getting to work with them still.
Reminds me though of what was that movie Searching for Bobby Fischer? I don't know if you ever saw it, but the kid's a chess player, and it's on private TV. It's like closed circuit TV, and one kid takes his queen, but the kid sees he's got him. And he reaches across and he goes, "I'm offering you a draw." And the kid looks at him and goes, "I just took your queen." He goes, "I'm offering you a draw," and the guy goes, "Move!" And he beats him. Yeah, that'd be an awesome scene with you and your old partners walking.
As if the practice of law is ever that dramatic.
But no, that's cool. That's a really interesting dynamic, and certainly you talk about, you know, Salzmanger, Lucy Bendesky, and the resources you have here, the fantastic experience. We're in this incredible, and I've done this show in this room. We're on location at Salzmanger, Lucy Bendesky, but we're on the 52nd floor of Liberty One. Okay, I don't know how many law firms or how many meetings are in this room when it comes to, you know, meeting with the defense, but certainly when they walk in here, it's like the White House, okay, being an unfair advantage with foreign heads of state. Talk about the resources that are here and in this room that allows you to represent your clients at the highest level.
Yeah, every piece of technology you could possibly want or ask for is made available to you. You have the collective wisdom of this firm, which is
infinite,
deep as can be. There is nothing that any of our cases want for that's not provided. The resources allow you to aggressively move a case forward and leverage every piece of factual evidence or discovery or investigation you need to bring the case all the way through trial to great results. I have never found myself in any position other than being encouraged to do what is necessary for the best interest of the client.
And we talk about firm culture, Okay, let's talk about that. Okay, you know, you're touching on it now. Okay, but in a sense, you know, normally it's David versus Goliath. Okay, but not in this case. Not with Saltzman, Galuzzi, Bendesky. But at the same time, it does have a small firm feel. Like, in other words, you know, you don't, you know, you're not, aside from your surroundings, which is absolutely incredible, the client, you know, there's, the one thing I can say in my experience here is that you talk about Dave Quaz and Larry and Bob and all the attorneys here, they treat you like family. It's not, you know, you don't walk in here, you might be intimidated for a minute, okay, but once you start talking to everybody, talk about that culture here of the big firm with the small firm feel.
Yeah, we get together for an annual softball game. We play against each other over at Penn's softball facility. We get out there and we sign up for the Philadelphia Bar Association 5K and run it together.
Just so you know, though, you don't beat me in a race. I'm just telling you right now. I'm about 260.
Well, Joe, I have a very hard time talking about myself, but I will tell you that I won the Philadelphia Bar Association 5K. So that is...
Really?
Yeah.
Well, so I have a pulled hamstring right now, Mike, and so I can't run right now. But, you know, and it's going to be down the road. But
okay, we'll put that on the schedule.
Yeah, no, it's going to be a while. The doctor said like 15 years. it's funny, though, because, you know, you talk about, and I did my research before I came. I know you're a runner, okay? And how long have you been running?
See, I hesitate because I almost my impulse or my reaction is to reject the label of a runner, although that's how I spend a lot of my time. So I've been running very consistently now for maybe 6 or 7 years. But, you know, I was an athlete in high school. And,
what'd you play?
I played basketball and track and field and baseball and you know, all the obvious sports that
So I asked that question because we've done a lot of segments on sports and the law, mm-hmm. okay? And that competitive nature, those tangibles, I'll say it for the 5,000th time, one of my favorite commercials. And I had a show with Bob Mongolusi, and I said, gives you that – where do you get that passion from? He was an athlete in high school and in college, okay? But one of my favorite commercials is – the one where you have they show the college athletes and they say, you know, 99.8% of these kids are going to be going pro in something other than the sport that they're in. But those intangibles, okay, those things that you bring to the table, okay, in the 5K, and, you know, in what you did in high school and college and all those things, how do they impact you on a daily basis?
Yeah, so one of the things that I find myself doing is I've run some ultra marathons. Okay. So
what's an ultra marathon?
An ultra marathon is technically any event that is, over 31 miles.
Yeah.
Okay. So I have done 200 mile races. The first one being out in Leadville, Colorado, which is, sits at 10,000 feet elevation. It's primarily the elevation throughout the course. It peaks at 12.6. You have to finish the race in 30 hours. So you're running when it's dark, sun comes up, you run all day, sun goes down, and you're still moving your body until the sun comes up again, and eventually you finish. And I did. And by doing something like that, not only do you learn something about yourself each time, but you also find ways in which you become comfortable with being uncomfortable, right? And I think that some of the keys to success and success in what we do are a few different things. One would be knowing that pain is just part of life.
And digging down.
That there will always be uncertainty. And once you understand that, and that there's always more work to be done. So when you understand that things are always uncertain, that there's always more work to be done, and that pain is part of life, then it allows you to really deploy a certain attitude and mindset with any endeavor that you go after. And it is very rewarding. I've never done anything more rewarding than the work I'm doing right now, and to go to bat for our clients who need us is fantastic. And you know, and I grew up in a household where my father had an injury to his hand in an industrial incident, and you know, I know what it's like to see someone deal with an injury like that throughout their life. And it's not something that I really paid much attention to until, you know, more recently, you know, and recognizing. And I think that allows me to bring a certain appreciation to what I do here, and combined with the mindset, I try to do what's best and what's right for our clients.
We've talked about this a number of times, but client expectations, okay? You reminded me of something when you talked about your father. And recently, really, delving into it emotionally, okay? And I bring that to, you know, up because you're now meeting with clients as they come in. And when they walk in, and we're going to talk about a case you just represented with Dave Quass and the team here at Saltzmonger Luzzi Bendeski. And I want to just ID the show. You're listening to the Saltzmonger Luzzi Bendeski Hour here on WWDB Talk 860. Our guest is Mike Zettelmoyer, associate here at Saltzmonger Luzzi Bendeski. But when them clients come in, okay, and there's no way to really by the way, I was an iron worker.
Oh, wow.
So my dad ran the ironworkers, and you see these buildings we're in right here. I can't tell you how many I've worked on, but from the other side of the window. So I know the view, okay? And, you know, we've had catastrophic injuries. And by the way, and I think everybody at the firm knows it, my father always sent everybody to Saltzmonger Luzzi Bendeski because, unfortunately for us, we had catastrophic, you know, they were catastrophic injuries. I'm not saying you didn't break a finger on occasion, but you know, as you can see, we're you know, these buildings around you. My cousin connected, and was the general foreman on Comcast. Yeah. Okay, and a lot of my friends. I mean, you're talking about catastrophic injuries. Talk about your preparation and you know your mindset when that family walks in. Okay, and at the same time relating to having the empathy of what your father went through and seeing that, and you're seeing that stuff on a daily basis from other people now.
Yeah, I mean, so what we do is not just the strict application and practice of law. We
100%.
We are there to be a friend or a shoulder to lean on or just someone to listen to.
Not just
clients.
A legal counselor.
Absolutely. It doesn't – you have to have that – sense of empathy and sensitivity to what you do and your approach to the clients, and never lose sight of the fact that their lives have been turned upside down. They don't understand the process. So you have a responsibility not only for zealous advocacy, but to make sure that their feelings and emotions are cared for as best as you can.
And because unfortunately, the ebbs and flows of these cases, no matter how obvious they seem to be, even legally, can take, you know, an exorbitant amount of time.
Yeah.
Okay, and so there are, and there's going to be ebbs and flows. So I imagine you become a personal counselor, you know, in a sense when somebody's getting lonely and money's getting tight because the breadwinner, you know, either got severely injured or worse, okay, there's all kinds of emotion and fears. How do you handle those conversations?
I think that it's important to stay connected to the clients, to update them, even when there's no update, to make sure that they feel very comfortable reaching out to you at any point in time with any questions they might have. And if they find themselves, you know, you mentioned maybe a financial situation or distress, to find a solution for them or figure out what can be done. There are various options in the legal industry to help, you know, maybe a client bridge the gap between injury or and the situation they find themselves in and the eventual recovery that we will secure for them.
Here's a fun, how does that differ from where you came from? You know, your clients before were corporate clients who, by the way, deserve just as zealous a representation, okay, or else this insurance system doesn't work. Right. So how does that differ, you know, from those situations? And was it natural for you? First of all, I met you 10 minutes ago, and you already have a warm demeanor and all those things. Did it?
Thank you.
When you came to Saltzman-Gosia-Mendeski, talk about that transition in client relations.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't really given that much thought before, although I do recognize there was some transition for me because my clients were professionals, and they weren't catastrophically injured. Their lives weren't turned upside down. They cared very much about their professional reputation, and by all accounts, they all wanted to take responsibility and do the right thing through the process. But there definitely was not that emotional baggage that our clients are carrying and the distress that they're in. And I found myself adapting to it quite well and recognizing it doesn't take a rocket scientist to recognize that our clients need somebody, right? And I already carry that because of my past experiences and background. And my wife works in the healthcare industry over at Jefferson University Hospital. She's
a physical therapist
in the medical ICU and the cardiac floor. And so
So she's dealing with catastrophic injuries also.
Yeah. Before I started doing this work, I would think that I'm having a bad day until I have a discussion with her and realize I'm not. So, you know, I love the fact that we are both spending our time and energy each day trying to make someone's life better.
And ultimately speaking, when you think about that, I think about the client themselves. What that client relationship, okay? What should clients expect from their attorney in this type of situation?
Honesty, transparency. You know, I think that there are a lot of attorneys that are uncomfortable having hard conversations. Sometimes there's a hard truth to our cases, right? I mean, it's not like every case where somebody is catastrophically injured can lead to a path of recovery. That happens, right? And there's an investigation process, and even if the it makes sense to proceed forward, it just doesn't turn out the way you hope that the evidence does, right? And that is a challenging discussion to have, but it can't be had without the ability to have difficult discussions and the transparency with a client.
A good example of that would be a work injury as an iron worker, and I just fell off the beam. I lost my balance, and there wasn't a negligent party. So it's still a work comp case. Okay, and I'm just saying cut and dry. And so not every case is a personal injury case. There's not always a negligent party. For our listeners, I've picked up a couple things by doing these shows. And I understand that as a layperson, you know, you're in a bad way when those types of things happen. The empathy, like you said, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to have it. But at the same time, one of the things I do know it takes is somebody who has enough patience to be able to counsel somebody legally and personally through a 3-year process. Because you mentioned earlier, when somebody's going through, you know, yes, you need to know the law. You need to know, but you also, it is a business, and part of that business is, you know, that communication level with the client and forming that relationship, or you're not going to keep any cases. Obviously, the success that they've had here, okay, and I know from doing the shows, it has been an absolute pleasure. The amount of professionalism, okay, and the caring, because that very conversation of, you know, the client attorney relationship, that is as much a specialty as fighting for the client, as knowing the law, as having the expertise. And so when you talk about a lot of those things, bedside manner, big talk about communications with a client. And because you just said something really interesting, you can avoid a lot of their, stress from staying in touch with them, even when there's not something that is up.
Sure.
Going on.
The clients don't understand the legal process. They're not frequent flyers. This is their first time through it. It's confusing. It's frustrating. It's slow. And when you don't hear from somebody, you make assumptions. So is my attorney doing anything? Has he forgotten or has she forgotten about my case? Does this mean my case is no good? What's the next step? So you can avoid all those questions and anxiety and assumptions just by having frequent communication often with the client, you know. And I just want to circle back to something you were saying about the resources of the firm and pursuing a case, and sometimes there isn't a case. One thing I know to be true is that if you come here to this firm with a problem and there's something that can be done about it, it will be done. I mean, there is no stone or that won't be overturned or process that won't be followed to find a way to make things right.
Okay. I'm listening to this show and I'm going, okay, this guy's clearly a great attorney, all these things, but there's no way I can afford him. I can't, obviously, talk about that. Talk about, what the contingent fee is all about.
Yeah, so that's a fee that varies from, case to case. It's within a range, but what that effectively means is we don't get paid unless we recover on the client's behalf.
So there's no out-of-pocket cost coming in, to get a consultation or to retain the firm.
Correct. And there's one important distinction about this firm as it relates to others in terms of that financial arrangement. We will spend the money to investigate and prosecute a case. It can be the cases that we handle, the cases that we investigate, whether it's a crash worthiness case or a product defect case or a construction aerial lift tip over, they can become very expensive just to investigate and figure that out. A lot of firms won't spend the resources or can't spend the resources.
Well, that's why I asked you earlier, we touched on the resources. Yeah. How important are, in a lot of these cases, getting the best experts to prove the case?
Yeah, it's a lot of our cases become, to some degree, a battle of the experts when you move past the art of persuasion and trial advocacy, which, the firm's results and background speak for itself. I mean, I went through the Temple LLM program in trial advocacy just like another dozen plus attorneys at this firm, which is the number one program in the country. So you have the skill set, you have the resources, you're well-funded, and you're encouraged to move forward and do what you need to do. And it's a powerful combination.
Before we get into the case, because we're going to get into it shortly, the reason these cases, these discussions are so important, okay, is because a listener, a member of the general public, a member of a labor union, okay, now when you're with a labor union, you get the benefit of the business agents and the business managers and the union presidents knowing who the top firms are. That's why, my father always referred to Saltzman, Luisi, Bendeski, okay? And we've talked about the first, I was just thinking about the first big case that the firm ever had happened to be my boss on the Frankfurt L.
Wow.
It was the Tropicana collapse. And his name was Mike Whitland, God rest his soul. And the firm did such an incredible job. My dad was the kind of, you know, he wasn't into business or anything. He was in the business of the union and all that, but he didn't have a personal choice of firms or attorneys. Bob Mongaluzzi and Larry Bendesky did an incredible job on that case. They're going to, you know, whoever else gets injured, we're going with the people who did such a great job. But it's vitally important that our members, are educated on these facts. I did a show not long ago with, it was a young lady attorney, and she was fantastic. But she was telling us a story about a woman who came in earlier that day. And she was not happy with her previous attorney, but it was a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend. And might have done landlord-tenant and was dabbling a little bit. And the first thing the lady asked was, am I going to have to pay for the expert again, right? And even though, and I know you're shaking your head, and so and every time I tell this story, when we talk about the experts, what you just said, so people understand, is sometimes these experts cost thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars, and you may absolutely need the top expert in the country to prove the case, and you will spare no expense to do it. It doesn't come out of the client's pocket, and that individual's life may be on the line or the quality of their life for the rest of their life.
Yeah, so the expenses at the end of the day are part of the case costs, right, that go into the fold of what is ultimately recoverable by the client. But the key thing, Joe, within there is that, number one, we have the resources to spend the costs on experts that are necessary for the client's case.
Sure.
But separate and apart from before you even get into suit, we will spend the money
to figure
out if you have a case. Now, if you don't have a case, ultimately at the end of the day, that doesn't cost you anything. It doesn't cost the client anything. I have seen and been part of spending $25,000-$30,000 investigating a case because it's the right thing to do for the client. And it has the possibility there only to be told by some of the world's leading experts that we would retain on a particular issue. It's just the facts aren't there. You don't have it. And, you know, you have that conversation with the client, and of course they're upset that there's nothing to pursue. They feel like they've been wronged, and they were wronged, and they're injured, and their life has been turned upside down. But once they realize that you spent $30,000 and, you know, 200 hours of your time to figure out if they have a case, you know, the dynamic of the conversation changes and they're appreciative.
Exactly. Ultimately, that, you know, they have to live the rest of their life, and knowing that is important. I've seen that happen before. Yeah. Having said that, let's talk about a recent case. Okay. We touched on it a little bit, okay, beforehand, but it, you know, it's a $9 million verdict.
$9.123 million.
Okay, and yep. So having said that, talk about it, Dave Quass. The first thing he said was, "Oh, you got to talk to Mike about this case." Let's set it up for us.
So Dave and I tried this case back in August. We had a tremendous support by the team here at the firm, and we represented the estate of Justin Riegel, who was a 38-year-old golf pro at Philmont Country Club, who died in June of 2020 when a 36,000-pound, 86-foot-tall pin oak tree toppled on the cart barn next to the pro shop and the putting green during a thunderstorm that goes by a fancy name of derecho. Okay.
What is derecho?
Derecho is just as I said. It's a thunderstorm that has some specific characteristics. For example, of high wind speeds. Travels for more than 200 miles in a straight line and causes damage and they're classified after the fact. So that was essentially the nature of the incident, and you know, we represented Justin's estate, and most importantly, we represented Justin's son, who was born 3 weeks after Justin unfortunately passed on that day.
And so so he was a golf pro. He was walking a client to
So storm comes in. People recognize there's the weather's turning on them. Part of the case obviously was us advancing the argument that they should have had a weather preparedness plan in place, that they should have known that the weather was going to turn south much sooner, that precautions should have been taken. But in any event, the powers that be closed the course, 10 or so minutes before Justin died. And in the process of that unfolding, Justin was doing what Justin did. He was helping one of the members of the club get to their car, get shelter. He was transporting, a cart back to the cart barn and then taking shelter himself when high winds came through and toppled over this gigantic, massive, big, beautiful tree.
I mean, that tree must have been there for 100 years.
Yeah, it was somewhere around a 100-year-old, 90-year-old tree.
I wonder if it was if they serviced the tree and what, certainly those things on top of a barn, in a lot of cases, my dad had one at his house. Okay, and it was like just looking at it was a nightmare.
Yeah. So one of the challenges in the case for us was that from an outward perspective, the tree was healthy. It had no defect. It had no disease. But the position that we took, rightfully so, was that a tree can be healthy and also be a hazard. So here, by virtue of its proximity, that it was leaning in the direction that would be downwind from summer storms, combined with the fact that the corporate entities that had responsibility for management over the course had a tree hazard policy in place that, wasn't really enforced to the point where this tree never at any point in time went through a hazard analysis or was considered for removal for any reason, at least according to them, by virtue of any hazard that it presented.
What's that prepping for those? So those are a lot of things you just said, that a hazard analysis and all those things.
Yeah.
Those things, I mean...
This case had it all. So we had a forensic pathologist, we had an economist, we had a forensic accountant, we had an arborist, we had a meteorologist. So that was the suite of experts that we had to hire, work with, and then present at trial to serve Justin's family.
How long did it take for that case to come to fruition?
The accident was it was June of 2020, and we tried the case August this year, 2024.
And did you get a chance to meet his widow?
Oh, absolutely, Kate Hannon. So Justin wasn't married at the time. He was in a long-term relationship with Catherine Hannon, who is the mother of Justin's son. And she was the representative of the state. She was the face of the case. And she was with us there every day at trial, as was Justin's mom, Yvette. And so the real reward, for us at the end of the day was knowing that, we had done something to change Justin's son's life and Kate's life.
Talk about the first meeting, though, with Kate and his mom.
Yeah, I mean, they are... they just wanted to do right by Justin, and they wanted to do right by Harrison and to secure his financial future and
that his father was no longer there.
Yeah, and
to
try
provide.
To yeah, and that's part of the case, right? That's part of a wrongful death case is the loss of the guidance and emotional support and all the things that Justin's son will never learn from his father. All the things that we, you know, unfortunately probably take for granted that we learned from our fathers if we were so fortunate.
When I was saying about what the first meeting was like, I'm talking about emotionally. That must be such a difficult, I mean, just trying to get through. You know, we all sit there and everybody talks about, you know, great jobs and I'd like to have, you know, I'd love to be a lawyer. You know, it's, I have a saying, or at least, you know, at my former business I used to own, you know, everybody wants to be the boss, but they don't really want to be the boss. In other words, being in that room is a life-changing experience. Talk about how that the loss, including with the son, shattered their lives.
Yeah, they're distraught and they're looking for help and they're looking for someone to lean on. And they're looking at you and trying to figure out whether or not they can trust you with this very, very important task that is to hold people accountable and manage a very difficult process ahead for them. Yeah. And so, you know, between Yvette and Kate throughout the process, it was an emotional roller coaster for them. And the only thing you can do is, again, it comes back to communication and answering their questions and making yourself available.
What was it like? You know, we talk about, you're an athlete and, what's it like when you're about, you know, you spent a couple years on this, now it's game week, but maybe it's game month. Okay. Trials coming up. First of all, did they offer you any, and did they make any offers?
No offers.
No offers. Now, you've been on both sides. What does that mean when you have Saltz Mongoluzzi Bendeschi, the number one, plaintiff's firm in the country? Okay. You know, they're not. You know, you didn't take this for your health. You feel really strong about it, and you don't get one offer.
It means it was a challenging case to try.
Right.
And that speaks to the resources of this firm and the talent of Dave Gwass and what's made available to us to take a case where the insurance companies and the corporate entities are saying zero, you get nothing. This little boy gets nothing, and we're going to try the case, and we're going to prevail. And we tried the case, and, you know, we closed, and then the phone started ringing. And the discussions were, you guys tried one hell of a case. What can we do to possibly get this thing done? But to answer your question about the process and that month, you know, in advance, it's all hands on deck. The job requires much from us to begin with, but when it comes time for trial, it is pushing ahead. And you know, and that's where my experiences and my attitude with ultra running, I think, really play in, because it is just moving forward and grinding and grit and determination. And, you know, you got to be looking forward. It's forward, not straight. And with the resources and the teamwork that you have available, there's just no stop.
And you're performing, okay, in front of that jury. Okay, so, I mean, what's that like?
Yeah, you have to always keep your head on a swivel. You have to remind yourself that you are the focus of attention.
By the way, where was the case tried?
Right here in City Hall.
Oh, in Philadelphia.
Yeah, so meet here in the morning. You walk out onto Market Street, and you do the walk down to the courthouse and start your day.
When it's game week, it must be like, I mean, you know, you must find yourself like pins and needles, everything going through. You know, probably not much unlike, you know, here we go. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it's Monday.
It's exciting.
The Super Bowl.
I look forward to it. I think that any of the trial attorneys around here look forward to it. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, that is the opportunity. That is the Super Bowl. That is to do what we really love to do. And by the time you're trying a case, you know it like the back of your hand. And so it is time to be flexible and quick and prepared and prepared and prepared and prepared so that you can pivot.
So you do your closing arguments, right? And I always looked at, you know, I coached a little football myself at middle high school football, and have a son and you know, always, but also played music. And so, you know, I always looked at it like, okay, there's two ways we can look at this. You can go out there and be afraid to make a mistake, and you're going to make one. Or you can prepare and get out there and say, look at me, I got this. Okay, now you can't, you know, being arrogant is not the way to fly, but the fact of the matter is that, that, and see, that's to me where the sports come in, where and even if it wasn't sports, any type of activity that requires a lot of those traits. So this case, lives are on the line. Okay, the quality of future lives are on the line. You make your closing arguments right in front of the jury. Okay, the moment that it goes to the jury, what's that like?
You know, you just you hopefully you sit back.
Is it like it is on TV? I mean, it's a nerve wracking. Like, you know, I say that because, man,
it is. So the air is heavy. You know, you can feel the energy and the pulse of the courtroom. You try to be reserved as trial counsel as best you can, and you hopefully you're sitting there in a position where you can look at yourself in the mirror and say, I did everything I possibly could have done for this family. This was their one time. This was their one chance.
Okay, so.
And then it's out of your hands, and you just hope they do the right thing.
Did you get an offer after that? Did you, you know, while the jury was out?
Yeah, so while the jury was out, we got phone calls and discussions, and like I said, it was, we thought the case stunk. You guys turned it into gold.
That's what they said.
And yeah, and we want to resolve this.
Did it settle before the jury came back?
So we entered into a high-low agreement, which is a way in which the parties can manage their risk, which is essentially a floor and a ceiling on what the ultimate recovery is, so that if the verdict comes back and lands outside of those brackets, you are stuck with the top bracket or the bottom bracket, or if the verdict comes back somewhere in the middle, that's the resolution.
Okay.
But it is in this case, in this situation, it was appropriate and the responsible thing to do.
And having said that, it also avoids an appeal, right? So in other words, that is a big deal. That can last for several more years, right?
Yeah, if it's done right and you negotiate the way you're supposed to, yeah, it's a done deal, which it was here, right? So, you know, verdict comes back at $9.123 million, the high-low agreement's in place, and it's done, it's over.
What was that feeling like when they came back with that verdict?
Oh, it's...
How do you avoid
name an emotion, right? and you know it probably attaches,
right?
And the most rewarding experience after, or in the moments after that verdict, was being able to give Kate a hug. And,
I was going to say, was it obviously, you know, his family was in the room.
Tears are flowing.
Awesome.
and to be able to, you know, look at Dave and know that. That we did the best we could and we did right was, you know.
Here's an interesting question. I, when you do get a settlement offer, you have a major responsibility there. Okay, in other words, to give it, you know, how do you handle that with the client? Okay, we have something here. You know, and I'll take it to another step. Imagine if you get a decent amount, and you tell, and you don't think it's a good enough, you know, situation. I mean, talk about counseling the client on whether they, I know they make the decision, but on whether they should or they shouldn't, or at least your opinion that you can do better, or you should go for it.
Yeah. So obviously, you report any settlement offer as soon as you practically can. You have an obligation to do that, and we do that. I think you need to understand the mindset of the client and appreciate what they're seeking to accomplish, right? And you know the value of the case and the risk of the case better than anyone at that point. And so in this particular situation, it was a scenario where I think the client needed to, and this was effectively the way it's communicated, needs to think about what they would regret more, right? And what they're ultimately seeking to accomplish. And here, Kate has two wonderful daughters. She's got Harrison as well. That's a financial burden for a mother who wants the best for her children.
Sure.
Right? So having the option to secure his financial future was worth its weight in gold, or, you know, what was being offered, right, in a very real way, as opposed to the very real risk of walking away with nothing. So that's the decision ultimately that had to be
made. And a great responsibility.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that is just an incredible story, and fantastic job, obviously. And thinking about, it just takes your breath away. Especially, we're recording this show on Halloween Eve. Okay, it's Halloween, so when we roll here, it'll air next week. But I think of his son, and you know, he's not going to be able to see him tonight. And so the fact that the contingency fee agreement exists, and you stand up and you fight for them, for those who can't represent themselves. It to me makes you heroes, and I mean that. If I'm in college and somebody says, you could be this type of lawyer, it's a contingency. You mean I don't get paid maybe for 3 years, and I might have to put money out, and I'm doing it on behalf of a client. It's an incredible thing, and I really commend you.
We appreciate you saying that. I appreciate you saying that, but truthfully, anyone who goes out there and does the best they can every day with their chosen profession, it should be recognized. And especially your background and your family. I mean, you guys built this country at real risk to yourselves. And so, we're not the heroes, and you guys are. But we appreciate the confidence that people like you and your family have put into this firm and the attorneys here over the years.
Well, it's mutual. I can tell you that. And before I close, I'd like to say one more thing. I had the opportunity to do a show with Bob Mongoose and Larry Bendesky and Dave Quas also. I mean, most of the attorneys here. One of the most amazing things that is due, okay, is you change is created in the courtroom, okay? And one of the things that I hear constantly is, yes, even from attorneys that talk about the desires and probably your client's family, is although the settlement's important, making sure it doesn't happen to somebody else. Talk about that reward also, and that goal and objective to not only do a great job for your client, but I talked to Bob about it, a story. A case where, a kid gets hit in the head with a baseball while he's batting and the helmet could only withstand 75 miles an hour. That kid was brain damaged. And as a result of that unfortunate situation, they improved the helmets. And I said, you mean to tell me that when you go to a Phillies game, you're looking at helmets that now can withstand the force of a baseball, in excess of 100 miles an hour, and you had something to do with that. And that must be an incredible feeling. And he said it is. Talk about that.
Yeah.
Big part of it.
A lot of what we do, the status quo is the enemy. Complacence is the enemy. And the idea is to send a message to make real change, whether that means physical change with a product or something the public interfaces with, or the attitude in which a corporation goes about managing or risk or safety to its workers or the public for that matter. And, the most concrete example I can tell you about from my own experience is Dave Quas and I were up in Luzerne County trying a case earlier this year, and it related to an absurd installation of a roadside barrier device, a guardrail type system on a public highway that ended up decapitating our clients. And it should never have been there. It did not comply with any standard or specification. We pursued the thing all the way through trial. It settled. And the very next day, Dave and I are driving back to Philadelphia, and what's out on the highway? And we couldn't help ourselves, by the way, not to drive past one last time to see, you know, what it looked like. And what's out there? An entire crew of workers changing the very infrastructure
so that it doesn't
that is
happen
dangerous
to
the public. And the what more do you need than that?
Mike Zettelmoyer, Associate Saltzman Uzi Bendesky, thanks so much for being our guest.
Thanks, Joe. It was a pleasure.
Fantastic broadcast. Really appreciate what you do every day. And you know, giving those who cannot represent themselves an opportunity to be represented at the highest level. I want to thank everybody for tuning in to the Saltzman Uzi Bendesky Hour here on WWDB Talk 860. I want to thank Larry Bendesky, Bob Mongolusi, and everybody here at the firm for making this show possible. On behalf of everybody at Saltzman Uzi Bendesky and, of course, our guest, Michael Zettelmoyer, I'm Joe Dougherty. Thanks for listening, everybody.